happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Mindful eating and meditation can lead to better metabolic health, University of California. They're talking about the 100 million Americans who have diabetes or prediabetes, who are overweight or have heart disease. All of these would be impacted. We'll tell you what it means in the specifics and how you can make changes. Also today, brain calcium controls how long we sleep. Now let's face it, we are a nation of insomniacs. University of Tokyo and Riken Biology Center did a study. And they found out it's all about the calcium in the brain. Well, how do we get it there? How much do we need? What happens if we don't have enough? I'll explain. A new study from the University of Amsterdam shows there's a link between the omega-3 fatty acids, that's your fish oil, or flax seeds, walnuts, avocados, and reducing depression. Well, we need that. And from Denmark, major university, Aarhus University, common painkillers are far more dangerous than we think. How dangerous? I'll tell you. Then psychology study finds cortisol, that's our stress hormone, is a key predictor of low birth weight babies, and older women have lost much of their advantage in living active lives. University of Michigan, this is a very important study published in the American Journal of Public Health. What it means is that women until about 10 years ago could easily expect to live 5 years longer than men, and that five-year period would be without having a lot of medical intervention. All that's gone now. What happened? In fact, women are living shorter lives. Wow, that needs to be explored. Also, the University of Edinburgh in Scotland found out how your immune system is impacted by bad bacteria in your guts and good bacteria. And it's the good bacteria that keeps deadly infections at bay. I'll talk about that. And vitamin D can help avert early onset insulin resistance from Ben-Gurion University in Israel. That could help an awful lot of kids prevent diabetes. And can bright light at night lead to obesity? University of Haifa in Israel. So those are just some of the health and nutrition issues we'll be exploring. But also today, we're going to have an audio clip that's extremely important you hear. There's two. I don't think I'll have time to get to both. But I certainly want to share one about who really was behind World War II. And this is fully documented. We have vetted this. And also, reality check. Hillary Clinton's not telling the truth about her super predator claims. And my guest in the second part of our program, and I'm going to leave plenty of time for him, is Chris Hedges. I believe, and again, I can be wrong on this. This is my own observation based upon looking at all the analysis. I believe that the liberal community and the corporate Democrats and the conservative community and the Republicans have all got it wrong when it comes to why people are supporting Trump. they've missed something that's right in front of all of us. And I haven't heard a single word about this in the mainstream or alternative media. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but when Chris Hedges, one of our nation's most insightful cultural, social, and political activists, investigative journalist, is on in a half hour from now, I'll begin our conversation with asking him. So let's start. By the way, a good study in nutrition and cancer that was done at the Veterans Administration Medical Center and Wayne State University showed curcumin, cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N, and resveratrol, res, R-E-S-V, eritrol, E-R-A-T-R-O-L. That's from grapes. That's why grapes are so good. And curcumin is from the spice turmeric. But if you took turmeric, you're getting a small amount of curcumin. If you took curcumin, you're getting it concentrated. That's why for any therapy as a functional herb, you should take it in curcumin. It can have a synergistic effect against cancer cells. Quote from the study. Researchers at Wayne State University report that a combination of curcumin and resveratrol showed greater inhibitory effects against cancer cells compared with either agent alone. And this was human colon cancer cells. So we know that taking two different ingredients are important, but when you take them together, you get the benefit of synergy. And that is what is so important. The other day I mentioned there was an Indian plant that could have a beneficial effect for diabetes. Let me spell the plant. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cellular Physiology and Biochemistry. And it had a substantial impact upon diabetes. It is a extract of the Gymnema, N-E-M-A, Gymnema sylvestri, S-Y-L-V-E-S-T-R-E, Gymnema sylvestri plant, and it found to stimulate insulin secretion in the laboratory, and that's very important. So this is an old Ayurvedic formula. And it had, quote, significantly stimulate the insulin secretion without compromising pancreatic beta cell viability. So if you are a person who has diabetes or prediabetes, this Ayurvedic, very important herb, was able to isolate, stimulate insulin secretion, and that's a good thing. And it did it with no adverse side effects. And also, when it comes to bright light, in fact, any light at night in your room, from a television, from your computer that may be off, but the computer should be turned off because A, it's emitting electromagnetic pulses, and B, there's generally a light, either white light or blue light, that is shining out into the room. You may have a window with some outside light, especially if you live in New York City or any city. You're getting the ambient light from outside. Any of those lights can go through the eyelid when it's closed, and it tells the brain it's daylight, and you stop secreting melatonin, and you start going into an anabolic state. And that's one of the reasons. There are other equally good reasons, but that's one of them. For not being able to sleep at night. That's according to this study. Now, then this was done at University of Haifa in Israel, but it went one step further. It said that also because you're not getting a good night's sleep, this is adversely affecting your metabolism and you're gaining weight. So artificial light at night contributes to excessive weight gain in men and women about as much as eating junk food. That was published in the International Journal of Obesity. Now, that's brand new information. So my suggestion is this. If you cannot control all the light coming into your room, get yourself one of those little cotton eye masks. They're very light. They're comfortable. You put it on, and that blocks out all the light. And that's what you want. Also, from Ben-Gurion University in Israel, early intervention with vitamin D in deficient individuals may help ward off early onset insulin resistance. So this was published in Diabetes, Obesity, and Metabolism, and they're suggesting that in this case, they actually used a placebo or 100,000 units of vitamin D bimonthly, and they came up with some substantially important results. So when you think of how many kids in America have juvenile diabetes, may it be simply because they're vitamin D deficient? That's one of the explanations. Vaccines are another, but this could help prevent that, and that's what we want. University of Edinburgh, treatment and prevention of life-threatening infections could be improved by research that reveals how bacteria are kept in check. Researchers have discovered how the immune system stops bacteria in our gut from leaking into the bloodstream and causing body-wide inflammation, such as sepsis. So our guts carry more than 10 times as many bacteria than there are cells in the human body. Now, mind you, you have about 40 to 100 trillion cells, so you get an idea how many cells your intestines carry. They're normally good for us if you're eating good, drinking good, and have a healthy digestion. But if you're eating sugar, drinking alcohol, having meat, no, they're going to be bad bacteria. And that can cause overgrowth of yeast, not just the intestine, but anywhere, including in the blood. And if it's really bad, it can cause thrush. It can cause extreme toxic reactions in the bloodstream. So clean up your gut, helps your immune system, and that's important. University of Michigan published a study in the American Journal of Public Health, and it said, quote, in a reversal of a long-standing pattern, a new study shows that older women in the United States have lost ground relative to older men in the number of years they can expect to live free from disabilities past age 65. The study funded by the National Institute of Aging was conducted at the university, and it says, quote, just a few decades ago, older women used to live more years than men without needing help taking care of themselves or managing basic household activities. But that does not appear to be the case anymore. Okay, what's happened? Well, here's what's happened, in part. My generation, the baby boomer generation, from 45 to 70, we have seen more stress, more environmental toxins, even in many of the conveniences that have been beneficial on many levels, but also come with a price, especially if used successfully or irresponsibly. Cell phones, computers, as examples, any form of device that is using wireless communications also bombarding us with electromagnetic pulses, that speeds up the telomeres. Those are the very important caps of chromosomes that portend a shorter or longer life. The shorter they are, the shorter your life. The longer they are, the longer your life. Also, when I was growing up, people would have a pizza, but it was rare. It was not often. You were expected to be home. You were expected to sit with your family, and you had a meal. Now, it didn't mean that all the meals were healthy. Our mothers, who were the ones who primarily made our meals, they did what they could because we actually had home economics classes and dietitians, but they were substantially controlled, though we didn't know it, by special interests, the dairy, the meat, the chicken, the sugar, the refined confection industry. So we didn't eat and drink these things because we knew they were bad and we just wanted them. We didn't think anything was wrong. I will never forget the time that a top person at the American Arthritis Foundation, a board-certified rheumatologist, came on my program on WMCA at the time, to debate me on, does arthritis have anything to do either in causing it or reversing or helping it with food or beverages? And their official position was no. Nutrition has nothing in the world to do with arthritis or inflammation in the body. Wow. They were so wrong. Now think of the consequences. Because they were wrong, people had a lot of pro-inflammatory conditions. This was not the fault of the people. More often than not, they believed that they should have protein 3 times a day. The protein they had was at lunch, it was bologna sandwiches or grilled cheese sandwiches. In the evening, it was roasted chicken or boiled chicken or steak, fish sometimes. And that was considered completely not just normal, it was expected. Vegetarianism, for the vast majority of Americans, for 99% of the American public, was simply some kind of cult fad that was kind of creepy and nobody wanted to be affiliated with it. In fact, the more meat you ate, the more you felt you were virile. And I worked out with guys who put away an awful lot of meat. These were nice guys. And we were powerlifters. There were six of us. And I was the littlest, and I was 236 pounds of all muscle. And one of them, when we would finish our workout, before he went home to eat, he would eat a whole fried chicken. Then he would go home and eat. I actually saw him put away 10, he was almost 300 pounds. I saw him put away 10 hamburgers at one sitting once. And he didn't do that because he thought he was being irresponsible. He believed that the more protein from animals you had, the more muscles you had, the stronger you were. And if you went into a lot of gyms today, you'll see a lot of these, if not most of these weightlifters, unfortunately, are killing themselves. Not just with the anabolic steroids, which really deform. They'll completely deform a woman's body. And they play havoc with your spine, your central nervous system, with your kidneys, with your brain. Tumors are very common. But they're taking way too much protein. But how do you change something where people are seeing, you know, massive muscles and they're saying, I got these massive muscles because I'm taking all these. And I'm saying, you could have the same massive muscles if you wanted. I don't know why you want them, but if you wanted those muscles by taking branched-chain amino acids and creatine monohydrate and D-ribose, and you could have terrific muscles. But they're conditioned and also propagandized. So there have been times when we have eaten at home. We've eaten the best that we could. A lot of mothers pride themselves on doing everything from scratch. A lot took everything out of cans and jars or frozen. And fast food only came later. But today, fast food is the same as home-cooked food in the minds of people. Schools prepare fast foods. I put a video up on my website that showed a Japanese school, and they teach nutrition. They teach how food is grown, how it's prepared. The kids actually are the ones that prepare the foods. They have to put on all these outfits, and they put on the masks, and they wash their hands, and they disinfect their hands, and they disinfect the tabletops. They don't have any of these infectious conditions in their schools, and they give different soups, vegetable soups, and miso soups, and fish, and rice, and grains and starchy vegetables, and it's not perfect, but it's light years ahead of what we have. And then you compare that with an Italian school or a French school, and you talk about healthy eating, you have to look at a French school and an Italian school, and you think, wow, they're eating better in school from their cafeteria than most Americans going into a gourmet restaurant. So this is what we're faced with. Now, put in there stress. When I was growing up, you were not expected to work at more than one or two jobs your entire working life. If you had more than two jobs, where you were considered shifty and not grounded and not responsible. So you prided yourself on finding a job out of high school or college and sticking with it. Imagine how many people were in jobs they didn't like that didn't honor them. Imagine how many people did what they were told to do, but they never honored their authentic life. Now, at least they knew they had security. There were three jobs for every person. So we had more than enough work. We had almost no unemployment, and we had a living wage, and as a result, people didn't have credit cards. They had savings in the bank. They were responsible financially. All that's gone for the majority of people. So today a woman is facing frequently honoring her authentic needs, which may or may not be in alignment with her partner or family, frequently finding herself changing through divorce or separation, losing her job, no matter how many years she was dedicated to working in a place, frequently going to psychiatric meds. 25% of all women in America between 25 and 45 are on psychiatric meds, and many are on multiples. Right now, I'm helping three different people get off 2 to 4 psychiatric meds. And when they said they went to their psychiatrist and told them they were having all these terrible side effects, including suicide thoughts, the psychiatrist simply increased the dosage of their Paxil in one case. This is how bad psychiatry and mental health has been. And then think of all the ways that people are expected to behave and what their role is today. So there's a great deal of confusion. Every one of the things I just mentioned will shorten your lifespan individually. Now take them collectively together. Take the sense of loneliness, the sense of despair, the sense of emptiness, the sense of incompleteness, the sense of depression. Those alone can prematurely take 10 years off your lifespan. Now look at how many of those comfort foods or junk foods that a person has eaten, or even people who have not eaten what they thought was a junk food but weren't educated enough on the real consequences of those foods, and they have coffee many times a day. That coffee, if coffee were invented today, it would never be allowed. It would be too toxic. And that's something I know a great deal about because I did clinical work research at the Institute of Applied Biology for my doctoral thesis on caffeinism. I published it in a peer-reviewed journal. So yes, you can find about 3 or 4 studies of what it does in a helpful way, and I'll show you an awful lot of studies of what it does to shorten your lifespan. And they confuse drinking the coffee and the caffeine in with the nutrient antioxidants, phytonutrients in the raw green organic coffee bean. And then think of all the soft drinks, high fructose corn syrup. Think of all the people that were eating margarine thinking it was healthy. So that makes up the reasons why today women are dying sooner and getting sicker sooner. And we have to change that by having a completely different educational program for women that really empowers them. Because there's nothing worse than seeing a person who is struggling and suffering who shouldn't, who should be thriving the older they get. And from Denmark, a lot of people in Denmark are prescribed non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for the treatment of painful conditions, fever, inflammation. But treatment also comes with side effects, including the risk of ulcers and increased blood pressure. But they don't tell you that when they're selling it to you on television. They don't start off saying, here's Robert. Robert was eating a lot of foods that quite simply he shouldn't have been eating. They were processed, high meat, high carbohydrate. He liked them, but they were not good for him. So he was taking these painkillers after he ate them. Well, now, unfortunately, he's got high blood pressure, and that's likely to kill him. And he has got inflammation in his joints, and that's going to incapacitate him. So he'll take a painkiller, which can also create ulcers, and 24,000 people will die minimally from that alone. You never see that part of the story. You just see people who couldn't eat something, and then they took this, and now they can. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, the COX-2 inhibitors, in my opinion, they increase your risk of heart attacks and strokes. They're deadly, and people should not use them. There are many ways, from white willow bark and aloe vera and the herb marshmallow. There are many ways that we can help a person who has intestinal pain, stomach pain, or joint pain. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories? No. Omega-3 fatty acids reduce depression, according to the University of Amsterdam. And there's a whole lot of people, 350 million, are known to be depressed according to the National Institutes of Mental Health. In the United States, we have 16 million, 18 and older, who have at least one major depression episode this year. And this was a meta-analysis. So how do you help these people? Well, first, I believe that you get away from your psychiatrist and you get yourself into the hands of a holistic talk therapist and take omega-3 fatty acids, because this showed that omega-3 fatty acid reduces depression. And that's good. And this was published in Translational Psychiatry. And brain calcium controls how long we sleep, University of Tokyo. Now, most people don't actively take calcium, and they don't take one that's well absorbed. According to the journal Neuron, the work shows how slow wave sleep depends upon activity of calcium inside neurons. Quote, although sleep is a fundamental physiological function, its mechanisms is still a mystery. And this multidisciplinary research showed that it's the calcium. So I suggest taking calcium and magnesium in equal amounts, let's say 400 milligrams, before you go to bed at night. And that will make a difference. And finally, mindful eating, meditation can lead to better metabolic health. According to University of California, in just lay language, a good, healthy, plant-based diet, daily exercise, add in mindful meditation, and you can lower metabolic risk factors compared to those who underwent the same program without the training. And so put it all together. You can lower your cholesterol. You can lower your blood sugar. You can lower your blood pressure. You can lower your waist circumference. You can lower triglycerides. You can lower the risk factors that lead to metabolic syndrome, and that's heart disease and diabetes and stroke. So you can save your life with a plant-based diet, daily exercise, and mindful meditation. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
To me. Oh, oh, I despise, 'cause it means destruction.
I'd like to welcome you from all over the world and for all the terrestrial stations around the United States listening. Thank you for sharing this program. I might mention that our website had 253 million visits in the last 12 months. And we have lots of people listening today over the telephone and sharing information. And the key is share what you believe is viable. We have over 1,200 articles, calls to actions, documentaries that we post every single week, more than Al Jazeera, more than the BBC, and ours are based upon progressive ideals, not ideological leanings to the left or right or corporate interest. And that's why people are coming and reading, listening, and sharing. Before we go to our guest, who will be here in just a moment. In fact, I was just told our guest is here. So we're going to go to our guest right now, and then we will come back later. I want you to hear something. This is Chris Hedges. He's, as I mentioned, one of the nation's most insightful cultural critics and social and political activists and investigative journalist. He spent 20 years as a foreign correspondent in war zones and conflicts in Central America and Middle East, Africa, the Balkans. He reported for the New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, and he won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for reporting on global terrorism. He received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights and Journalism. He's authored many best-selling books. His most recent is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt, which is a philosophical and historical and timely clarion call for a new revolution against a repressive political and corporate group of individuals. Chris's weekly column can be read every Monday on Truth Dig, and his TV program, Days of Revolt, is aired every Monday at 11 p.m. Eastern Time on Telstra TV. Nice to have you with us today, Chris.
Thank you, Gary.
Chris, I feel that the media and the old guard of the two main parties have been mistreating Bernie Sanders, denying completely Jill Stein, and in one particular way, though I'm begrudged to say it, Donald Trump. Now, yesterday, the Washington Post reported from the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning that holds more of the young adult vote for those under 30 years of old that both Trump and Clinton combined. And he holds 71% of the young vote. Trump, on the other hand, primarily represents male, white, older, and less educated voters who are not necessarily Republicans. And when it comes to Trump attracting college-educated Republicans, his numbers are low, around 8%. Polls show Hispanics hate him, and educated Republicans, about 53%, strongly oppose Trump's immigration rhetoric against minorities. Nevertheless, this segment represents a sizable part of the U.S. population who are low-income, working-class, and likely many of them are underemployed or unemployed. And, of course, many of these are also heads of families who have seen their factories closed, 60,000 since 2000, 9 million jobs flee overseas. And what Sanders and Trump supporters share in common is distrust of both parties in Washington. For them, it's a political system run by career politicians and bureaucrats and moneyed interests. And under the status quo, neither our educated youth nor our poor, less educated white working class observe either party working on their behalf. So here is my concern. I can be completely wrong on this, but I'd like for you to do your own intake on this information. I believe that America has been in the beginning processes over the last couple of years of going through the American Spring. Completely unidentified and non-labeled, because when we think of the Arab Spring in Tunisia and Egypt, and they tried in Bahrain, didn't happen in Saudi Arabia or Jordan or Kuwait or some of the other Qatar, but we do not recognize that Americans who had worked in factories that gave them gainful employment for decades, frequently generations, are now out of work. Or if they are working, they're working way under their capacity to pay their bills and maintain any quality of life. Because these people tend to come, though not exclusively, from lower education groups, and they tend to be invisible to the media. But when I was out for 6.5 years, traveling, frequently weeks on end, going into towns all across America and interviewing people for Poverty Inc., I saw them. And they were frustrated. These are not political people. These are not ideological people. These are just people whose primary interest is putting food on the table, having a roof, being able to pay their bills. They live relatively simple lives. And we are now seeing that there's over 150 million of them. So little under half the American population are just below, at, or above, just slightly, the poverty level. We've got 18 million food insecure children. We have 1.6 million homeless school children. We have around 49 million people on food assistance, but we have 106 million underemployed or unemployed people who simply no longer are counted in any of the official statistics, which are a mockery at 5.2%. And these people have no advocates, they have no voice, and I believe they are looking at a Trump or a Sanders as someone who will go out and help them fight their fight, and left unchecked, if their condition is not changed, and I don't believe it will be with anyone in power, we may see them go violent at some point over what may seem to be a rather insignificant situation. Your thoughts, please.
I think I would agree with most of that. I'm not as forgiving to Bernie Sanders. Sanders consciously ran within the confines of the Democratic Party, although he knows as well as anyone that the Democratic Party has been as complicit in the transformation of our political system into what Sheldon Wolin calls inverted totalitarianism. He's been 25 years in the Senate. He's seen it. But he has had a kind of long Faustian relationship with the Democrats, who do not mount a serious challenge against him in Vermont. And in return, he not only blocks the rise of third-party candidates, and as you remember, he was one of those voices calling on Ralph Nader not to run as a third-party candidate. He has seniority in the Democratic caucus. He gets committee chairmanships. And he campaigns for Democratic candidates, including Clinton in 92 and 96. Now, in 92, you could say Clinton was an unknown entity, although what he had done in Arkansas was pretty awful. But by 96, he had passed NAFTA or pushed through NAFTA. He had destroyed the welfare system, and 70% of those recipients under the old welfare system were children. He had passed the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill that exploded our prison population in an effort to take back the law and order issue from the Republican Party. And Sanders has said that should he not be the nominee, and it appears now very likely that Hillary Clinton will be the nominee, he will campaign on behalf of Clinton for the Democrats. Making a mockery of this whole kind of rhetoric about a political revolution. So I think you're right in that people on both sides of the political spectrum are turning towards a Trump or a Sanders because they have lost faith, as they should, in the capacity and the rhetoric, which is completely mendacious by both parties. In a sense, neoliberalism has been called out for the con game that it is. But the attempt by the Democrats to bring supporters, Sanders supporters, into the Clinton camp, I think is a very dangerous one. If you look at the numbers of voters, the Republicans are pulling twice as many as the Democrats. The Democrat numbers are way down. And fascism traditionally builds its base on two elements. One is the rage, legitimate rage, I would argue, as you would too, of the white underclass, or the underclass, but in particular the white underclass, because the so-called liberal establishment continues to speak in the language of multiculturalism and diversity and inclusiveness and tolerance, although the assault on black families has been worse than the assault on white families, but the white underclass hears that rhetoric, and that gives demagogues like Trump a kind of credibility when they say that you have been sacrificed so that these marginal groups have been empowered, undocumented workers, and, you know, the long list, GBLT community and everyone else. So it's not true, but it works as a rhetorical device on the part of the right, because the Democrats pretend that those are values that they champion, when in fact they don't champion any values at all. They are completely captive to corporate power. So it works on that channeling of a legitimate rage. And remember, many of the people, as you pointed out, who were brought into the Trump camp have not been particularly active or active at all in electoral politics before. And this is also, if you go back to Hannah Arendt, a fundamental feature of totalitarian movements, in that they mobilize a group of people that have no tradition or loyalty to any party. And they are empowered by a bankrupt liberalism, a so-called or self-identified liberal establishment that stands for nothing but empty rhetoric. And so that combination, and Clinton is kind of the poster child for this, so that combination, that mobilization of a base, an enraged base that has been outside the system, coupled with an apathy, around a bankrupt liberal politician is very dangerous. And on the issue of violence, I mean, I covered, you know, the breakdown of Yugoslavia. When you get people to speak in the language of violence, eventually you get acts of violence. And he is appealing to a segment of the population that venerates the gun culture and, you know, have concealed carry permits and are extremely angry. My greatest fear is that, you know, he very easily co-opts these, you know, militia types and who, you know, seek to express their dissatisfaction through violence into his campaign. And, you know, eventually someone gets shot.
Let's go back to Sanders for a moment. Sanders, I believe, is on the right side of an issue when it comes to challenging Wall Street, free education, and helping. I would eliminate all student debt if we could eliminate all corporate debt, as we did for the major 22 largest banks and corporations, with $21 trillion over a 6-year period. We could certainly eliminate $1.2 trillion in student debt and their loans, if we chose to, and yet we choose not to. And when it comes to Sanders on his foreign policy, this is where the media is not touching him. He
right.
supported Saudi Arabia having even a greater role
right.
in the Middle. How in the world could it have a greater role in Yemen, since it's the primary cause
right.
of 13 million people being food insecure? And why hasn't Sanders mentioned anything about Hillary Clinton's link to the Honduran violence and the coup that occurred in Honduras when she was Secretary of State, knew all about it, and supported it?
Well, I mean, the problem is that I mean, you're very right. His foreign policy, his voting record on war, he did oppose initially the Iraq war, but then he voted for all the appropriations bills to keep it going, and the security and surveillance state, and stood up like an AIPAC wind-up doll to vote with the entire Senate, unanimous vote, calling on Israel's right to defend itself as it was bombing refugee camps in Gaza. And that gets to a really important issue, because all of the social and economic reforms that he proposes will not be possible until we challenge the defense industry, the military-industrial complex, the war machine, which is sucking the marrow out of the bones of the state. And he won't do that. I think Sanders' power, like Trump's, is that he acknowledges the reality of inequality. If you listen to President Barack Obama's State of the Union message, you would have thought that the economy was flourishing, and that, I mean, it was just a complete exercise in a kind of mythical or illusionary vision of what America was. And both parties have been doing it. I think, as you mentioned before, the unemployment statistics are completely fictitious. I mean, real unemployment is pushing 20%, according to the LA Times. So Sanders, like Trump, acknowledges the reality. But Sanders is going to attempt to funnel that energy and the money back into the Clinton campaign. And Trump is the con artist he appears to be. He of course, has no intention of betraying his own class. He functions, I think, a lot like these figures in what anthropologists call crisis cults after society's decay. The ghost dance in the end of the 19th century was an example of that. So the decimation of Native Americans is almost complete, massive genocide. Their lands are taken. The buffalo herds are killed off. And so you get this movement where people gather together and they dance in a kind of inducing a kind of trance-like state. And they believe that the white people will disappear and the bullets can't go through their ghost shirts, and the buffalo herds will come back and the great warriors will rise up from the earth. And that's kind of what Trump is doing. I mean, this thing about winning, 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 I'll be the biggest jobs creator, America will be great. It's so divorced from reality, and yet people are so desperate.
Chris, I have two articles. One is from Matta Kramer and Chris Hellman in Tom's Dispatch. It's called Homeland Security, the trillion-dollar concept that no one can define. And it talks about, imagine a government department so bloated that few have any clear idea of just what its countless pieces do. Imagine that tens of billions of dollars of tax dollars are disappearing into it annually. Black hole style, since it can't pass a congressionally mandated audit. Now imagine that there are two such departments, both gigantic, and you're beginning to grasp the new 21st century American security paradigm. And here they're talking about the not the Department of Defense. They're talking about the Department of Homeland Security, which has grown into a miniature Pentagon and yet is unaccountable. And you know how much money they spent? $791 billion on Homeland Security. And yet the entire New Deal for spent on inflated adjusted money was $500 billion. And despite taking all that money that could have rebuilt crumbling infrastructures from coast to coast, this agency and the very concept of Homeland Security have largely flown beneath the radar. And yet no one's talking about that waste. Then we have Ralph Nader saying this, quote, uncontrollable Pentagon and corporate contractors too big to audit. And it goes on to talk about that there's $585 billion or more for the Afghanistan and Iraq conflicts of our money, not just unaudited, but in the sober judgment of the Government Accountability Office of Congress, this vast military budget is year after year unaudible. That means that the congressional auditors cannot obtain the basic accounting data to do their job. And then they find out where all this money went in Afghanistan and Iraq, and most of it went for corruption or to cronies. And you look at just those two. Now, we're talking about two separate amounts of money. That's over $1 trillion. And think what $1 trillion would have done if it was applied to helping those poorest of Americans in greatest need, to help them. Could you share your thoughts, please?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, that all money is siphoned off for internal and external security, and none of it's accountable. We don't even know how much it is. I mean, technically, for instance, about 54% of the budget goes to the military, but that's false because it doesn't count Veterans Affairs, it doesn't count our nuclear weapons program, it doesn't count internal security and surveillance, estimated about $100 billion a year. We don't know. It's a secret budget item. And that's how empires die. They expand beyond their capacity to sustain themselves. They hollow the country out from the inside. You can see that in city after city. And they employ the harsh forms of empire to maintain control. So drones, militarized police, wholesale surveillance, indiscriminate use of lethal force, suspension of habeas corpus, empowering the military to act as a domestic police force on the streets of our cities. I sued the president in federal court, won, and then he appealed, so it's law. You know, we're following the same kind of trajectory that brought down other empires like Rome. So meanwhile, you have a rapacious, out-of-control, oligarchic elite that orchestrates a legal tax boycott and pillages mind-numbing amounts of money. And I thought I did like Bernie's comment the other day about Walmart, where, you know, he correctly called out Walmart, the Walmart family, which keeps wages so low that a lot of their employees, the average worker, works 28 hours a week at Walmart. They qualify, they're below the poverty line, they qualify for food stamps. So, I mean, he said get off, he's calling the Walmart family to get off of welfare, but that's really what it is. It's a system of corporate welfare.
And collectively, they're worth over $150 billion, the brothers and sisters who own that. They could surely afford to be generous, but they're certainly not spiritual. One area that is never discussed by the American media, unless it's in 100% praise of Israel, is will we allow Israel to be held accountable for any of the things they've done to create this Palestinian state? Every member of Congress, every member of the Senate, all 100 voted in support of a resolution condemning Palestine and Palestinians and supporting Israel. I want you to hear this. This is members of the English Parliament who are not as beholden to AIPAC. And I'll just play a short piece of the clip, 2 minutes, then I'd like a response why we don't have this in the United States, an honest, open discussion on how to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and at least be honest about its origin.
This is not just a war about rockets from both sides, but it is actually a war about illegal settlements and stolen lands. And what is the next big political move? I have sat here these last 30 years and heard the same statement every year for 30 years, and nothing has happened.
Hoffman.
Is the Right Honourable Gentleman aware that among the 173 innocent civilians slaughtered by the Israelis in Gaza was the inhabitant of a disabled people's home, which was hit by Israeli targets, and that a hospital was hit as well, that whatever one says in deploring the role of Hamas, and I have told the Hamas Prime Minister to his face that I deplore what they do. Nevertheless, if this goes on, we shall have yet another cycle, the third so far, there will be a fourth, it will go on, and unless the Israelis are willing to make peace, the day will come when the Palestinians will explode in anger and despair.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The whole House condemns the killing of those three Israelis and the burning of the Palestinian, and none of us have any truck with Hamas. But is it not clear that for all the vacuous words of the Israeli government and the IDF spokesman, that they have no regard themselves for international humanitarian law, that they place a completely different and much lower value on Palestinian life compared to Israeli life, and that this cycle will go on as long as the international community, in an effort to be even-handed, fails to say to the Israelis that the actions that they are taking are completely outwith the United Nations Charter and any idea of how a civilised nation ought to behave.
Ben Bradshaw.
Secretary Kerry and his own Middle East minister have clearly said that it was the Netanyahu regime's relentless expansion of illegal settlements that bore prime responsibility for the collapse of the Kerry talks. When, rather than this routine language of condemnation on the settlements, can we instead have some real and meaningful action?
Mr. Martin Horwood.
Foreign Secretary is absolutely right to call for a permanent end to these intolerable rocket attacks on Israel, but right too that too many civilian and children, too many Palestinian civilians and children are dying. Will he consider whether or not the favourable economic and political relationship with Israel and between Israel and the European Union should now be reconsidered in the light of the Israeli government's disproportionate response to these attacks?
Burden.
She is, of course, correct that the escalation, this latest escalation of tit for tat rockets and military strikes brings peace no closer. It just brings death and destruction. You may be aware that I, with honourable members, was in Gaza just weeks after the 08-09 Operation Cast Lead and saw for ourselves that humanitarian centres by the UN had been hit by Israeli strikes. As he said, 17,000 Palestinian civilians are now sheltering at UN centres, and the UN reports 49 of those already being damaged. As a high contracting party to the Geneva Convention, what can Britain do about this? Will he confirm that hitting humanitarian centres is a war crime?
your thoughts on this, where people actually spoke up, and we've never heard any of these voices speak up, with the exception of Cynthia McKinney, in the U.S. Congress.
Well, and as you know, she was heavily punished for it by the Israeli lobby. Well, first of all, Britain doesn't have the, so-called Israel lobby that has the kind of power it has here and the kind of resources and the kind of money. Europe has just long been far more courageous about calling Israel out. But I think it's emblematic of a system that is essentially ruled completely by cash. And these people in our Congress will say anything and do anything for cash. And the Israeli lobby has a lot of cash. So if they need elected officials to stand up and justify the murder of Palestinian children, the wholesale murder of Palestinian children, 500 were killed in that last bombing campaign by Israel. There's no shortage of people who are willing to do it. I mean, the wholesale security and surveillance apparatus in Britain is pretty sophisticated, but ours is, our system essentially is one where there's really no vestige of legitimate democracy left.
My final question is this. Since there's going to be a point in the near future, I believe, where Bernie Sanders one day will drop out when he is, it's shown that he does not have the votes and from the superdelegates and the other delegates, and he will then turn over all these more idealistic young people to Hillary Clinton. And there's going to be a certain place within Trump's campaign when people realize how little he actually knows, how reactionary and narcissistic he is, and there'll be people wanting another place. Explain why Jill Stein would certainly be an enormous improvement over both of them when it comes to dealing with domestic issues and international issues.
Well, I'm supporting Jill Stein. I mean, I've long, as you did, supported Nader and voted for Stein in the last election because the platform is a sane and rational platform, both in terms of foreign and domestic policy. But I don't think that we just should get caught up in the elections. I mean, the whole system's fixed. I mean, Clinton went into the elections before the first voting ever took place with 500 more delegates than Sanders because the party gave her 500 delegates. They built up a vast, through money, patronage machine. You saw it in the South. Cornel West called out a lot of the black politicians, including John Lewis and others, for essentially being captive to the Clinton political apparatus. And I think that we have to, I vote as a kind of protest vote, but if we want to wrest back our democracy, that is going to require sustained acts of mass civil disobedience. I mean, the logical next step would be shutting down the conventions in Cleveland and Philadelphia, the problem being that the state, which has a pathological fear of protest, in essence, declares a kind of de facto martial law in cities where conventions take place and not only infiltrate and monitor any groups that they suspect might carry out protests, but flood the police with equipment and helicopters and drones and barricades and keep people blocks and blocks away from where the convention happens. And I think that we've got to begin to start thinking about acts that can impede the process. I certainly supported the people who went and disrupted the Trump rally in Chicago. I thought that was great and courageous. I think that's the kind of stuff we have to do. And I am going to vote where my values are, which is Stein. But I you know, the same was true with Ralph. Until enough of us, 5, 10, 15 million people, step outside the system and won't budge, we are going to continue this kind of drift. As you know, the whole kind of theory that voting for the least worst is an alternative belies the fact that with the least worst, we get worse and worse and worse. We may not get it at quite the same accelerated rate as under the Republicans, but it's a drift we have to halt. I mean, Barack Obama's assault on civil liberties is worse than Bush. He's the one who ordered or empowered or authorized the U.S. government to carry out the assassination of U.S. citizens. I mean, this is just staggering. And he's the one who signed into law Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act. Well, these are all tools of, you know, draconian state repression that could potentially be handed to a Trump.
Well said. Chris, we'll continue this conversation. I appreciate your input. Your newest book is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. The television program Days of Revolt is aired every Monday at 11 p.m. Eastern on Telesure, TELESUR TV. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
Chris Hedges, I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.